Adam Kay has been very open with what turned him off working as a doctor and turned him into a successful writer and comedian. He'd been working as a junior doctor on a labour ward in the UK when an incident in surgery went catastrophically wrong. Adam kept a diary throughout his medical career, which formed the basis of his wildly popular memoir called This Is Going to Hurt. The book, which came out during an NHS strike, became the best-selling non-fiction book of the century and was made into a TV series. Adam Kay followed with a sequel called Undoctored. The BAFTA award winner's also turned his work into comedy fodder, and This Is Going to Hurt will be part of the New Zealand International Comedy Festival with two shows at Auckland's Bruce Mason Centre on 1st May. And he's now turned to writing children's books, including Kay's Anatomy, Kay's Marvellous Medicine and Kay's Brilliant Brains. Adam Kay has also kept up advocacy since leaving the profession, appearing before a parliamentary committee in the UK talking about pay, conditions and training. I asked him what his expectations were at the beginning of his career in medicine.
It's a very interesting question. Certainly back home in the UK, you make the decision to be a doctor when you're 16, essentially, when you're choosing which subjects you want to, you know, do for your exams. And that's a very bad age to decide to do anything, let alone the career you want to do for your entire life. And so I'm not entirely sure I knew what I was getting into in the slightest. I came from a family of doctors. I went to the kind of school that churned out lots of, you know, doctors and lawyers and that sort of thing. And in medicine, we talk about informed consent. If you have to go for some kind of procedure, they'll say, right, here's the benefits of it and here are the risks. And I don't think I had informed consent about going into it. I just think I was sort of struck by, you know, the fun side of it. And no one actually mentioned that, you know, sometimes these days, you know, sometimes you have bad days.
What was it that was the overwhelm apart from obviously the things that go wrong and the bad days, Adam? What was it was the overwhelm? Just the sleep deprivation, the shifts, the sheer expectations that just nobody can really anticipate until they're in it?
I think so. I think certain things I did anticipate. I knew it would be long hours and things like that. But the things I didn't expect, like, it didn't occur to me that of the 7 Christmas days that I was qualified as an obstetrician on a lay board, I'd only get to see my family for one of them. It didn't occur to me that every 6 months in the UK, you rotate to a completely different hospital. And some of these hospitals would be very far away. So, you know, every once or twice a year, you'd have to move flat. You'd have to move 80 miles away. That didn't occur to me. And it didn't occur to me that there's an expectation that doctors shouldn't be human because humans make mistakes. And so as a result, there's an expectation on you don't do other human things like get sick or get sad. And so you end up just plowing on and pressing on. And I think all of these things combine to make it a slightly like chronically stressful environment. And added to that, there would be these acute stresses where, you know, you do have that really bad day.
Can we talk about some of those? And, you know, obviously there was the incident that ultimately saw you leave the profession. And I'm sure that's hard to talk about even today. But what does it say about the system that things could get to this point?
I'm going to go into a huge detail, but essentially when you're, you know, if you're the most senior doctor on a labour ward, all you want from every patient's minimum is a healthy mum and a healthy baby. And I had one of these situations where, we had neither of those two things. And look, these things happen and it's part of the job and it's no one's fault. But what struck me was there was no mention of a debrief afterwards and I wasn't offered a second off work and I wasn't offered a minute of counselling. It was just the expectation, just, you know, get on with it because that's what doctors do. And I mean, there's a couple of things there. One is there's this culture that says that. But secondly, there's probably not enough slack in the system to be able to say, maybe you need a couple of weeks off there. And so it all adds up to a slightly dysfunctional approach, I guess.
You've been outspoken in many forums since, about what is wrong with the system. And what are some of those things that you would like to see change? For example, you've commented in previous interviews about how medical schools always want students to have a lot of other things under their belt. What are some of the fundamental things that you know are going wrong, even in the selection and training of doctors?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So I think we try and pick people who are too academic to be doctors. You know, certainly back home, it's all about you've got to have your straight A's in all your exams. You've got to be captain of the rugby team, and you've got none of that matters. It's not a job about memorizing, you know, biochemical pathways. It's a job about communicating. And I think we need to be, first of all, honest about what the job actually is. And secondly, pick the people who are good communicators with their patients. Because if you don't have that, you've got nothing. And also, communication, I don't think, is taught particularly well in the medical schools. I mean, they teach you how to break bad news and how to do this and that. But not once for a minute in my 6 years at medical school did anyone say, you're going to need some ways of coping yourself. So I mean, there's a lot of things that can change. I think things are starting to get better since I wrote my first book, but I think there's a long way to go yet.
You also, it's quite clear from the way you left the profession, you really didn't have a choice, Adam. This wasn't about necessarily sitting there and saying, where am I at? What am I doing? It pretty much broke you.
Yeah, it was a tough time. I mean, I didn't go and seek professional help afterwards because that's not what doctors tend to do. But in retrospect, I quite clearly had some kind of post-traumatic thing going on. I would be, you know, I would wake up most nights of the week at 3 a.m. with my heart going 200 beats a minute in a cold sweat back in that operating theatre. And it took a very long time for any of that to subside. It did have a big, big effect on me.
And you, again, you have been prepared to speak out on behalf of others. You've referenced, for example, the high suicide rate among healthcare workers as being an outrage. What change, if any, are you starting to see now?
I mean, any healthcare organisation is an enormous ship to steer, and the idea of making any changes is difficult and it's slow. But I have done everything I can to try and address the mental health of doctors. And that first occurred to me when my first book, This Is Gonna Hurt, came out, because I talked very honestly about struggling, and I had huge numbers of messages from doctors, you know, emails and social media and whatever, saying, until I read that bit in your book, I thought I was the first doctor who'd ever cried in the locker room, who'd ever cried in the toilet. But the truth is that almost every doctor finds himself in that locker room. But the fact that no one talks about it, acknowledges that's fairly normal, means that on top of whatever bad day you've just had, you feel like you're struggling and you're failing, and that's very isolating. The suicide rates amongst medics are very high across the world. So there was a study in the Australian New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry last January, which said that a healthcare professional across the two countries takes their life every 3 days. It says that the suicide rate amongst nurses and midwives is twice the number of the general population, twice the rate. It says that amongst medical students, 1 in 5 in the last year had suicidal ideation, so thoughts about taking their own lives. These are such high numbers, and they're worldwide, and it's a huge universal problem.
There's the second book, of course, Undoctored, and again, you know, funny, heartbreaking and, you know, shocking stories from life on and off the wards. What's been the response, and have you been surprised by the universality of response to the books, Adam?
I've been really surprised, because I thought, when the first book, This Is Gonna Hurt, came out, I'm just one doctor bloke from the UK writing a diary, I thought it was a very particular, peculiar story about the NHS. But within no time at all, I was getting messages from all around the world, and not just from English speaking countries. I was getting messages from, you know, Venezuela and Chad and wherever, you know, from doctors saying this could have been set on my ward. And I was pleased that, oh great, it sort of resonates in other places and other people like my silly disgusting stories and whatever. And then it became quite depressing that this is a problem that the world has rather than just my little country.
It was essentially your diary of your time as a junior doctor, right? And had you always written through life? Was it a way of processing life for you?
I think in looking back at it, that's exactly what it was. At the time, I don't quite know why I was doing it. I was just, you know, I'd go up to my hospital and cool room and I'd write down the silly, the funny, the weird thing that happened that day. And what I was doing, I was looking for the light amongst the dark. I'm glad I did it, because that wasn't the only way I had to deal with this stuff.
At what point does this then begin to come to the stage? I should say, I'm pretty sure that you were part of a comedy group while you were training, right? While you were at med school.
The only thing when I left medicine that I had vaguely approaching a skill set, I thought, was comedy. Because the only thing I'd done other than studying medicine was there's a tradition in UK medical schools, I don't know if it's the same in New Zealand, of, you know, getting up on stage and doing funny sketches and songs and things. And I'd done a bit of that. So when I stepped away from medicine, that was the only thing I could think of doing. And since medicine, that's what I've done. I've been a writer and I've been a comedian.
Bringing it to the stage then, and we're talking about This Is Gonna Hurt, coming to the Comedy Festival, what can people expect?
Hopefully, I mean, I've made myself sound quite sort of earnest in this interview.
You're not. It is
a comedy. So I tell stories from my books and from and not from my books about my life as a doctor and sort of peeking under the hood of what it's like working on the wards and some of my favourite moments. But hopefully, at the same time, when people leave the theatre, they've not just laughed, but I've hopefully talked about something that's made them think a bit as well.
There was the BAFTA award, of course, for the TV adaptation. And did that come naturally? Like taking a book that's sold millions, right, that's had an incredible reach, and then adapting it to TV and now bringing it to the stage. You know, has it been a natural progression for you?
I really enjoyed the adaptation. It wasn't like the natural kind of book to adapt, because it was, you know, one person's diaries. And so the direct adaptation would have been, a slightly strange sort of one person sketch show. But so it was quite a broad adaptation. I was so pleased with how it turned out. And I was so thrilled, particularly for Ben Whishaw, who got a BAFTA for Best Actor. I think he did the most amazing job doing both the drama and the humour, which he does so well.
Where do we find the humour? It's interesting, when, you know, whether you're patient or, in your case, doctor, it is, for all its stresses, for all its tragedies, for all its line calls, it is an area where black humour invites itself often, right? In the sense of, you know, finding humour in very, very painful and difficult times. And do a lot of audiences just respond to that? They've all been there to one extent or another.
I think so. I mean, I don't quite know how or why I've managed to tap into this, but people seem to enjoy hearing these stories. I think it's, you know, it's endlessly relatable. We all encounter hospitals. We're all born in one for the most part. Well, most of us will die in one, and we'll probably spend a lot of time in one along the way. And there is this, we do deal with some of this stuff through humour.
You were also the author of children's books, of course. Can you tell us some more about those the experience of writing them and the drive to write them?
So, yeah, I've written a few kids' books, all non-fiction books so far. My first one was called Kay's Anatomy, which was basically teaching kids about the body. And I think my drive for that is I find the human body the most absolutely fascinating topic there is in the world. But for some reason, it never gets really high billing at school. It's never cool, like, you know, space or dinosaurs or whatever, probably because we're forced to learn about it. And so I wanted to try and retool that slightly. And so I wrote a book which has got all the facts in that kids need to know about, you know, all the science stuff and the bodies and diseases and all that, but to make it disgusting and silly and funny. And it's, yeah, that seems to have worked quite well. Lots of kids, certainly back home, have read that. And kids are an amazing audience. Adults will always pretend to, you know, like what they've seen or read and be polite and all that. Kids are 100% honest. If they hate something, they'll tell you they hate it. But when a kid tells you they liked something, that means a lot. And also to hear from parents, and for whatever reason, these books seem to have got quite a lot of kids into reading, because I think there isn't much funny nonfiction, certainly at home. It was something brand new for kids who'd struggle to get into other kinds of books for whatever reason. So there's nothing more rewarding as a kid's writer than hearing from a parent saying, my son, daughter, you know, never used to read, and now they've read this book 5 times. Amazing.
Kids love the gooey and the gory, and actually they're shameless about their bodies until we make them shameful.
100%, yeah. And there's a huge amount of sort of taboo busting to be done at an early age. And I, you know, whilst when I've got these kids on side, you know, because they've heard all of my disgusting, as you say, gooey stories about the bowels and whatever, I can talk about, you know, stuff they need to know about. I can talk to them about drink, and I talk about cigarettes and neurodiversity, and I can talk to them about all of these, you know, all of these things that they might not, you know, otherwise face up to or be talked about, or that could become taboo. And hopefully they trust me because I'm the silly, funny person.
Also, you're able to bring some messaging in there, everything from how to fact check to overlooked female inventors and scientists and others. There's a streak of justice running through so much of what you do, Adam.
I think there's a responsibility, isn't there, as a writer to push things forward a bit and not just write the same book that the last person wrote. And I think the arts have the most enormous value, and you can, you know, not wanting to be too grandiose about it, but you can make a bit of a difference. And if you make people, particularly at an early age, sort of look at the world slightly differently, then you absolutely should.
Your own life has changed, of course, becoming a father yourself, no amount of night shifts and no amount of jet lag quite prepares you for that, Adam.
That's very true. I think the thing that surprised me most, makes me seems absolutely idiotic, but the thing that surprised me most about having kids is it's relentless. Like, at least in medicine, when you've done your 12-hour, 24-hour shift, the shift's over and you can get a nap. After you've finished your 24 hours with the kids, there's just another 24 hours that starts straight away. So I do miss them most terribly, being away from the country for a couple of weeks. But on the other hand, I don't think I've slept better for years.
What has it been like speaking about your life, being more and more open about your life, especially having established such an enormous audience? So you, in your heart of hearts, quite a shy person. A lot of writers are.
I really am. It's a very strange disconnect. Like, so, for example, I talked to you before about that incident that meant I left medicine, and, you know, and I stand up on stage and I talk about it to lots of people at the time. But when it happened, I didn't speak to anyone. You know, my parents didn't know about why I'd left medicine until they read it in my book. My husband didn't know the details of why I'd left medicine until he heard me say it on stage, reading out from my diaries for the first time. And it's so I am essentially a private person, but, you know, I do it because it's good for me. I realize that now. And also, I hear from other people that it's helped them, you know, a bit of honesty and openness about some of this stuff. And I'll keep going as long as people keep rocking up to my shows and buy my books, I guess.
Is there a safety, in a way, on the stage to talk about very, very difficult things, but where it's your space and the audience is sharing it, but it's your space and you're in charge of it? Is that different sometimes from conversations we might have, I don't know, with our parents or our loved ones or our good friends? There's a bizarre liberation to the setting.
No, you're exactly right. It is a performance. It isn't a dialogue, and I can control how I'm saying these things, and I can rehearse it, you know, a dozen times, and I can preview it, and I can get it right. So, and as you know, and as honest as you are on stage, it's never, you know, I think sometimes people are quite surprised when they meet me after a show, you know, after every show I do, you know, after, you know, when I've done my shows in Auckland afterwards, I'll be at a table afterwards signing books. And sometimes people do say when they meet me afterwards, oh, I thought you were going to be, you know, you're going to be sort of, I don't know, bigger than this. And part of it is probably because I'm just knackered because I've just been on stage for an hour and a half. But some of it is that, you know, you are like your bedside manner as a doctor. You know, when you're on stage, you're turning it up a bit.
What do you want from your audience? The same strange question to ask. What do you want? Where do you want to move them?
I like to surprise my audiences, I think. I like them to come with the idea that they're coming to a comedy show, which they are, and I'm gonna endeavour to make them laugh for 90% of it. But also, I want them to leave thinking something slightly different to what they came in thinking about. I want to sort of subvert their ideas of, you know, what you can achieve in a comedy show slightly, if that doesn't sound too strange, and just sort of bring up a couple of topics that, you know, whether they're a healthcare professional or whether they just know one, they think about it slightly differently on the way out.
You want laughter and tears, perhaps, in some instances.
I'll take tears. What I've had slightly enough of, I think, is people collapsing. I had a few of those in the last couple of months. It's just, but luckily, when people do have medical emergencies, it tends to be some of the safest theatres in the world, because there's hundreds of doctors and nurses and midwives there to look after them.
It's not a direct consequence of the show, do you think? It's just someone having a bad night, or do you think it's a direct consequence?
I don't really. I won't take it too personally.
To take something a little bit more seriously, though, to finish, because you are generous with what you share of your life, not only your experiences in medicine, but also in your personal life and some of the traumas of your personal life. Writing books and you know, performing stage shows that millions love, certainly the books, doesn't solve everything. And, you know, to people who are surviving what you did in some instances, what else would you share? You know, getting through the PTSD effectively that you had when you left medicine, getting through some of the other traumas of which you write and speak. What's mattered in doing that, Adam?
So I think there's two parts of it, both of which I initially did very badly when I was a doctor, and now I'm getting better at. And it's, your mental health's a bit like your physical health, to be honest. You need a first aid kit at home, and you need to know when the first aid kit just isn't going to cut it. And so I don't think I had any basic ways of dealing with the bad stuff at all. And now I'm quite good at, you know, realizing when things are getting a bit much and knowing the tools that I can employ, which are different for everyone, to get through those bad days. And also, like with a physical injury, you know, sometimes, you know, you're not going to be able to walk just by strapping up your ankle. You do need to pop to the emergency department to get the x-ray or whatever. And so I now know when I'm getting to the stage that I do need to put my hand up and say to a friend or say to a professional that I need to talk. And I think as a society, we're getting better at that in general, but still, I don't think we take responsibility for our mental health as well as we do for our physical. And there's this, and the two go together. And whatever your job is, you can't do it unless you're looking after yourself both physically and mentally.
Adam Kay, Ed, he will be performing here with This Is Going to Hurt as part of the New Zealand International Comedy Festival. Two shows at Auckland's Bruce Mason Centre on 1st of May. Details on our webpage.